billionaire spending way more than any of the people we're talking about are spending, was not able to buy or frankly get really even close to winning the Democratic nomination. And then on the other point of the spectrum, you know, you have Bernie Sanders, who in 2016 and this time created a grassroots army. I think Elizabeth Warren this cycle showed that this was not a Bernie-specific phenomenon, that it was possible to replicate it too. So for all the attention we're spending on kind of these big, larger-than-life billionaire figures, there's an argument to be made that their profile is overinflated and that they can do their big passion projects and think they're changing the election, but maybe they're not.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today is the reporter Teddy Schleifer at Recode, which is now owned by Vox. Teddy currently investigates the wealthiest people of Silicon Valley, people like Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, or Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google, and how they spend their money, including their involvement and influence in American politics. This includes hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for political organizations, often in the world of partisan political activities, technology, and data. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you will listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Teddy Schleifer at Recode.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. So my name is Teddy Schleifer. I'm a reporter here at Recode, which is part of Vox.com. And I cover Silicon Valley money and influence and how it's spent. So that means covering politics and philanthropy and kind of the conversation around billionaires in society. My family's in Dover, Delaware. So I grew up a couple places, but lived my last couple years in Delaware and then went to Princeton undergrad, fell in love with journalism there, and then went to the Houston Chronicle. First job out of college, covered Texas politics, sort of covered Ted Cruz from the early parts of his campaign. And then during 2016, I was at CNN writing about mostly Republican politics, and I covered the Cruz campaign super closely. I was one of the first real national reporters in covering Cruz full time. And in 2017, like a lot of people in DC, I moved to San Francisco, where I've lived for the last couple of years.
So let me ask you a few more things about that. Like, what kind of family was that in Dover? Like, is it a political family? Is it a, are you the son of a billionaire? What's,
not anywhere close. my mom's a professor. There's a historically black college, Delaware State University in Dover. So my mom's a professor and we moved to Dover. It's actually interesting. There's a lot of people in Southern Delaware who have moved from, the New York suburbs over the last couple of years. And New Jersey, and you know, they generally are of different types of people who have moved to Southern Delaware. So it's an interesting place to kind of a hodgepodge of people who are either military families, Dover Air Force Base. Listeners may be aware of kind of where the federal mortuary is. There's a historically black college. There's a big NASCAR track, which I'm guessing will have lower attendance this year than in previous years. Yeah, Dover's Southern Delaware definitely feels like the South in lots of ways, unlike Northern Delaware, which is all of, you know, 30 miles away, which is Philadelphia suburbs mostly.
And didn't you go to a elite private high school?
I did. I did. Good oppo research. Yeah, I got a scholarship to go to the alma mater of Andrew Yang and Tom Steyer, which is Exeter, and I had a really wonderful experience there. Definitely not scalable to fix all of American education, but for those who are lucky enough to get money to go there, definitely felt like it changed my life in a lot of ways.
You must have done well there to go off to Princeton. When you were at Princeton, you studied politics, American studies, and fell in love with journalism. What was it about journalism that attracted you so much that it seems to have been the course of your career so far?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it seems obvious that I would have fallen into this. I think it's a career that is made for people who like to be professionally annoying and like to ask questions. And you sort of have the right or the ability to ask anybody anything. I send tons of cold emails and in ways like that I feel as if you're not allowed to be embarrassed in this line of work. You can just email anybody. If they don't respond, that's great. Or that's fine. Maybe not great. Yeah. So during college, I worked for my college paper, the Daily Princetonian. And, you know, we sort of tried to take an aggressive stance and, you know, model kind of the journalists we wanted to be a couple years down the line. So my big break during college was a story that David Petraeus wanted to be president of Princeton. This is just before the scandal erupted in 2013, I think. So yeah, I covered Princeton pretty closely.
How did that come to you?
So Petraeus is a PhD alumnus of Princeton, and he had always kind of, you know, privately had made these sort of joking comments about how he was interested in being, you know, because at the time it might be difficult to recall, but there were questions around 2012 about whether Petraeus wanted to run for president of the United States. Petraeus would always say things as his, you know, deflection. He would say, "The only thing I want to be president of is Princeton."
Of course, that's a path to president of the U.S.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson. And so Petraeus would make that comment in sort of a joking way. You know, that was not the biggest scoop in the world that he had said that privately, but he wasn't kidding, as basically our story showed. So after Princeton's president resigned in the fall of 2013, I may be misrecalling the year, but we kind of reported that Petraeus was actually genuinely interested in serving as president of the university, which was sort of my first big national story.
Did you find there was kind of a high around that, around the attention and kind of having the scoop or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I think for the same way that lots of operatives feel the thrill of victory. I mean, one of the good things about journalism is you do a quick story or a long story or something that breaks through and has impact. It's definitely a high. And, you know, like that's I think what keeps a lot of people going is the adrenaline of the business. Now, there's different paces for everybody. I mean, some people get a real high after, you know, spending months and months laboring on a story and it breaks through. Other folks get a high off, you know, off of a good tweet.
What took you to Oxford?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to study abroad. And so I spent a semester at Oxford and, you know, it was my first real time traveling outside the United States. You know, wonderful experience. Definitely realized during college that everybody that doesn't study abroad ends up regretting it. I remember afterwards, I came back from studying abroad and I went on this kind of crusade to convince other people to do the same, because I think there's a lot of people during college who, in, you know, show up freshman year wanting to go abroad and then somehow end up not doing it because it's because of a leadership opportunity on campus. You know, well, if I go abroad, I can't be, you know, the president of my dance troupe, or I can't be the editor-in-chief of my newspaper, or yada, yada, yada. And I sort of tried to make people balance that against the hidden upside of going abroad. So that was a crusade for a little bit, but I definitely, you know, that was a highlight of my experience for sure.
Would you rather cover a candidate that you think highly of and might vote for, or a candidate that you have a lot of distaste for and would never vote for?
One of the joys of covering politics is that you can sort of separate yourself from that decision. You know, I really enjoyed covering Ted Cruz because I thought he was a fascinating figure who genuinely liked reporters and was someone who was always keeping you on your toes. And, you know, I think the people I'm drawn to covering are figures who are genuine, figures who definitely enjoy media attention. That's kind of how I've thought about who I enjoy covering the most.
I mean, he's known to be an intelligent, good debater, things like that. What did you learn about him, covering him, that most of us wouldn't know?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, I mean, Cruz definitely understood the role the press played in the campaign. I mean, Cruz, you know, his people that are close to him admitted at the time, you know, as someone who very much understood the role of media in politics, and as someone who genuinely, I think, liked a lot of the reporters that he dealt with, which in some ways I think has some similarities to Trump, even though there's kind of this rough exterior toward reporters. You know, Trump is someone who grew up, as other people say, obviously I didn't cover Trump full time in the 1980s, but, you know, someone who genuinely likes reporters. And I think Cruz is the same way. And he's someone who I'm sure there were some comments that he made during the campaign about, you know, stories, even a story of mine or a story of a colleague's or whomever when I was at CNN. But Cruz is someone who understood the value the reporters played, and I think genuinely, you know, tried to master that game rather than pretending the game didn't exist.
It seems like a fairly symbiotic relationship a lot of times.
I honestly think it depends on, you know, the candidate's personal feelings toward reporters, which I don't really know if that's somewhere on some chromosome somewhere. But, you know, for instance, I had friends during 2016 who covered the Rubio campaign, for who for a long time was sort of in a similar tier as Cruz, if I recall correctly, in terms of the credibility of the campaign.
A top tier.
Yeah, top tier, but not Trump or not Jeb Bush. And apparently, you know, the Rubio campaign was much less fun to cover because Rubio was, you know, I guess the caricature was him as somewhat robotic and not someone who kind of engaged on news of the day in a way that Cruz did. So Cruz was someone who was, yeah, I really enjoyed covering him. And I thought he was someone who got it and understood the game of politics. So even though he and, you know, Marco Rubio were both the exact same age and, you know, were both Cuban Americans and both were United States senators, you could have a very different experience covering Cruz versus Marco Rubio.
Did that mean you followed them around? You were traveling with them?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I was at CNN. CNN's a big place with a lot of different bodies. So I was working for CNN Digital. So this is not on the television side. I had people that I worked with on the television side as well.
You did a lot of covering of money and politics there, I guess. How did that shape what you think about money and politics? What did you take from that?
In addition to covering Cruz, the other thing I primarily covered was, yeah, campaign finance. And I still find, you know, for all the attention that's paid on everything else in DC, I still find campaign finance to be woefully undercovered as a topic. You know, even when I was there at CNN, there were probably only five or six reporters nationally who would be scrutinizing FEC reports. I'm a believer that transparency is a good thing and that, you know, if there were twice or three times as many reporters covering campaign finance, we'd probably have a better democracy. Yeah, so I mostly covered conservatives and kind of the GOP world, either whether it was Cruz donors or, you know, during the general election, I covered the Republican campaign finance world. So, you know, Charles Koch, American Crossroads, stuff like that, Sheldon Adelson. You know, it's been interesting. I mean, I think the Republican donor world is, at least today, is much more concentrated than the Democratic donor world. As we'll talk about in a little bit, I mean, the Democratic donor world is very atomized. A lot of billionaires sort of funding their own projects. And Republicans have sort of consolidated into a couple of constellations, you know, whether it's the Charles Koch world or the Senate Leadership Fund, which is sort of Mitch McConnell's world and Karl Rove's world. But, you know, every cycle, you know, I haven't covered campaign finance full time since I left CNN in 2017. And there's always new innovations, right? You know, a decade ago, I guess, was around the time that Citizens United was decided. There's always some lawyer who has a clever way to figure out a new scheme. And that's, to some extent, that's just the American democracy and how the world works. But there's always going to be a new innovation every cycle. And in 2016, I mean, it was these massive super PACs that covering the Cruz campaign was interesting. They had, I don't know if listeners recall, but Cruz had these like three or four related super PACs, each run by individual donors, which I wrote a lot about, that were technically separate groups, but were all called Keep the Promise. So there's always fun stuff in this role. And I think it's definitely in the public interest for people to know about it.
I definitely think so. And sometimes the most important stuff is the hardest to find out, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's not always a press release on the scams, unfortunately.
Right. How did you find yourself at Recode?
I knew that during the campaign, I really enjoyed campaign finance stuff. And it really made me think about, what did I like about it? And I think what I liked about it was the ability to understand the world of wealth and how money is made, it's spent, and not just in politics, right? I mean, a lot of my days was spent in 2016 trying to understand, you know, how do these people's business interests intersect with their political support? What's the source of their wealth? If someone donates $1 million to a campaign, is that a lot of money or is that not a lot of money? So I realized I wanted to understand the business world better, and I wanted to think a little bit more holistically and broadly about the way in which wealth is made and spent. And there's no better place to do that than in Silicon Valley. Yeah, so Recode at the time was totally independent from Vox.com, but Recode is a new media publication that wanted to understand, you know, the enormous wealth creation of the tech industry. And they brought me out here in mid-2017 to try and unpack that. So I'm doing that for now for the last 3 years.
To me, it's a really interesting beat. It seems like a fascinating area to wander around in and try to understand and try to communicate about. But what is it about the world of wealth and how it's spent that attracted you?
These are sort of intentionally opaque worlds, right? I mean, I'm always amazed at how often I am interested in institutions that I cover out here that don't have websites. The family office of someone like Larry Page, the founder of Google, who, you know, has a net worth of $60 billion. These things don't have public profiles. So it's not as if, you know, there are reporters who are trying to do this, who are doing a bad job. This is a feature, not a bug. This is how it works. So I think, you know, what's interesting to me about it is obviously, you know, this is a time of unprecedented income and wealth inequality. And the charitable foundations that these billionaires have set up, the ways they spend their money politically, the companies they run, these are all matters of public interest. And I just feel like there's too few eyeballs on this stuff. And I'm not coming to it as a critic of, you know, I don't really have a strong opinion about, you know, what's legitimate, what's not, you know, how much wealth inequality is too much or too little. But I'm just a believer in the same way there's scrutiny on campaign finance and political contributions. I feel like charitable contributions and other spheres of billionaire influence require good reporters.
I agree with that, and I'm glad you're doing it. What other reporters do you think are also doing good work in this general area?
So on the kind of philanthropy specific world, I mean, there are some philanthropy trade publications that I think do some good stuff and definitely cover the world much more closely than I do on a day-to-day basis. You know, I think there's a lot of political reporters who cover campaign finance who are very, very good. Probably some of my favorites are Julie Bykowitz at The Journal and Shane Goldmacher at The Times, two people who I've gotten to know a little bit in 2016 and a little bit along the way. But I definitely think there's too few people. I mean, to be clear, the water is warm for any other reporters who I won't be too jealous if there's a major scoop they get that I have invited them to write about. I feel as if I'm the only person in San Francisco, at least, who's writing about this stuff. I mean, most reporters that are focused on campaign finance are in New York or DC. And there are some reporters here in Silicon Valley who dip in and out on stories about tech and politics or billionaires more broadly. But definitely feels like there's too few reporters covering, you know, a lot of important stuff.
You covered mostly conservative campaign finance at your previous job. And from what I've read, most of your articles are more on the Democratic side right now. Is that intentional? Or, I mean, there are obviously conservative, wealthy people in Silicon Valley who are in the politics game. Are you only interested in one side, or what's your thinking?
Not at all. I mean, I wrote a story last year about, you know, Trump came to Silicon Valley, I believe last September, for a fundraiser. So I wrote a story sort of about Trump's Silicon Valley support last fall. And definitely that's something I'm interested in writing about over the next couple of months. You're correct though, that, you know, the sort of the thesis of my story last September was there are these sort of quiet Trump supporters who don't really want to talk about their support of him for a number of reasons, like even figuring out who was hosting the Trump fundraiser last fall, which was usually not a typically, you know, top secret piece of information, who's hosting an event that, you know, has local law enforcement guarding the house. And, you know, these are not top secret stuff. Even that was a bit of an adventure. But you're right. I mean, I've generally focused, at least, especially because there was a competitive Democratic primary over the last year, I've generally focused up till now on Silicon Valley Democratic donors. But I, you know, if anyone has a great story about conservatives in Silicon Valley and things they're doing, especially people who are not Peter Thiel, who has been written about ad nauseum, I'll take any and all ideas.
Are you interested in the billionaires outside of that area, or are you pretty just focused on Silicon Valley?
No, definitely. I'm definitely interested in it. I mean, I think having some definition helps with going deeper on subjects, but I've definitely, you know, there's obviously a broader conversation about billionaires in society. You know, you've seen during Democratic primary debates, questions like, should billionaires exist? And frankly, it's sort of a distinction without a difference, because, you know, if you look at the list of the wealthiest people in the country, I think six of the top 10 or something like that are from tech. But, you know, I've written a little bit about kind of Bloomberg world, and, you know, I'm interested in, you know, Soros a little bit, but I've tried to kind of keep my bullseye on sort of tech figures as the people I'm most interested in right now. But obviously there's a broader conversation about income inequality that you can't ignore.
What have you learned about billionaires and their role in politics, or at least the ones you've covered?
I've only been in Silicon Valley since Trump was elected, so I don't have a great comparison point. But, you know, over the last 5 years or 4 years, there's been this awakening of tech and of tech money that, you know, for a large amount of time was generally kind of apolitical, you know, generally moderate. You know, Obama, they were big fans of his. And once Trump was elected, though, you've seen all of these new people who have a lot of money start cutting serious checks. So right now, you know, the relationship between sort of tech billionaires and the Democratic Party is complicated because on the one hand, lots of these politicians, probably most prominently Elizabeth Warren, you know, want to regulate the hell out of them and maybe even break them up. And then on the other hand, you have simultaneously, the Democratic Party is still very much dependent on these tech billionaires to fund their grassroots campaigns, fund their super PACs, fund their 501c4s. So that tension between Democratic Party and Silicon Valley billionaires has been the core of my beat over the last year in a way that probably wouldn't have been as interesting 4 or 5 years ago when it was all sort of hunky-dory between Obama and tech wealth. There wasn't this visceral disgust in a way that some Democratic politicians feel about the tech rich. In a lot of ways, tech to some politicians has become as toxic as oil. That's something I'm exploring right now.
So let's talk about a few of these people, these kind of larger than life. I've heard them referred to as masters of the universe.
Yeah, probably by themselves.
There's not a shortage of ego.
Yeah.
When I started doing this podcast, I started a business in politics and technology, a Democratic firm. And I had done that without any funding and bootstrapped it. And over the years, I had seen occasionally money coming into the space and every presidential cycle, at least trying startups. But that has transformed dramatically post-Trump. And so I started talking to people. Take Reid Hoffman. Like, I've never talked to him, but I have talked to some of his political money spenders, Dimitri Melhorn and people like that. When I talk to some of the entrepreneurs in the space, the political entrepreneurs, their attitude is like, I would like to get funded by someone like that. That would really help me move my ball forward. When I talk to people who aren't entrepreneurs, who don't stand to make money, but are practitioners, a lot of times their take on it is something like, these Silicon Valley people come in, they don't really know what they're doing. They make investments that don't really make sense or disruptive. They don't care. And we had something that already worked. Now that's changed over time as people have gotten more experience. But what do you hear about someone like Hoffman and his investments and how do you understand them?
You know, so we wrote the story last week about the four horsemen of Silicon Valley donor world right now: Reid Hoffman, Loreen Powell Jobs, Eric Schmidt, and Dustin Moskovitz. All four figures of them have their fans and their detractors. But, you know, Reid Hoffman was the founder of LinkedIn. He was someone who I think pre-2016 was not necessarily as political as he is now. I think he's a good example of someone. You know, I think this cycle he could very well end up spending $100 million. Reid is a great example of someone who's been politicized in the age of Trump. And there's definitely questions about whether or not Reid will stick around in Democratic politics if he's successful in ousting Trump. But Reid is probably the most toxic of those four figures among the Democratic Party establishment. There's probably no project that epitomizes this more than a data startup called Alloy, which he's put about $18 million into and could put in more, which is a data warehouse that is kind of meant to, you know, address some of the Democratic Party's digital deficits. But, you know, Alloy has had a pretty, you know, at times chilly relationship with the Democratic Party. And my story, I quote on the record the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party, who, you know, thinks Hoffman is arrogant and thinks that the Democratic Party had its own data file. Why are we reinventing the wheel? And I think that's the broader criticism of Silicon Valley billionaires more broadly, is that they feel the system was working and they feel that just because titans of industry have figured out how to develop something like LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever, that doesn't necessarily make them experts in everything, right? And there's sort of this arrogance that I think lots of tech figures get tagged with, fairly or unfairly, when they start playing in the political arena.
I think part of the Alloy thing also is that there are existing data companies, Target Smart and Catalyst, as well as the DNC. So you come in with Alloy and it's disrupting a lot of relationships. But I did talk to an entrepreneur the other day who said, I'm getting my data from Alloy. And I said, why? And he said, it's cheaper.
You would know this world better than anybody.
Well, no, but I know some things about it. And I've been talking to people just like you have, and it's just
the world of democratic software, I guess, is your bailiwick.
What's amazing, though, is I find it very hard to find out about the new things that are going on. Another one is, I think that you mentioned, is that democratic data exchange, right?
Right, which is very low profile.
Super hard to find out about.
Yeah, and again, like, I don't think this is not always a problem with us not being good enough at Google. I mean, this is kind of the way these things are set up somewhat intentionally. Yeah, I mean, there are some Democrats who feel that democratic data exchange is duplicative to Alloy. And the question is, why is Reid Hoffman funding something that we're already doing? In fact, one of the things I talk about in my story is not even all tech billionaires are on the same side of this. One funder of the Democratic Data Exchange is Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, who has many billions of his own money, who has been very interested in sort of helping the Democratic Party in probably a more hands-on way than Reid Hoffman has been interested in. So those are sort of competing projects. And I think the concern is from some on the left is that neither of them is going to be sufficiently set up for 2020. And as we report in the story, a lot of people feel Alloy has been underachievement. Democratic Data Exchange, unclear if that's going to be ready by November 2020. So for all the energy that's been focused on this, you now have two different efforts. And the concern from some senior Democratic operatives I talked to for the story is that neither of them is going to be firing at all cylinders come November.
There's also, as I understand it, sort of a host of startups, actually many of them I've talked to, but I don't really know about the sources of their funding, that are vehicles for wealthy people who are playing in politics to try to make impact. You know, all kinds of both tech and non-tech enterprises. What have you learned about that?
What sort of things?
Well, there's the portfolio of New Media Ventures or Higher Ground Labs, for example, right?
Got it. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I was talking before about how the Republican donor world is much more coordinated and concentrated, at least it was when I was covering it full time. The Democratic, donor world is sort of in a let a thousand flowers bloom sort of mindset. And, like a venture model, like Higher Ground Labs and New Media Ventures are both, we'll invest in a lot of stuff. Maybe some stuff will work. Maybe some stuff won't. To some extent, this is kind of how venture capital works and how, you take swings and you see what connects. But there's definitely, a lot of stuff out there to the point where, I even have trouble keeping track of everything.
What's partially interesting to me with all these billionaires that you're talking about is how little is going into this. I think the largest number that you've talked about is that 18 plus million. I've heard up to 35 with Alloy. Any of these major wealthy people can spend that easily. And what's going on is the leadership of the United States, and that matters trillions. Is this a lot of money going in to these sort of ventures where tech people are playing, or is it not?
Obviously, on both the right and the left, there's a ton of money that goes into 501c4s or 501c3s that none of us know really how much money is going into these organizations. So, we have some super PAC disclosures. I've done some reporting to get a general ballpark on figures. But, if someone has put $5 trillion into, some secret thing without a website that is, waiting in October to pounce, I don't know about it. So I think that's one point. I mean, I think you're totally correct that one of the reasons that I came out to Silicon Valley, as I mentioned before, was to understand the broader context of how money is made. And there are certainly, if you look at, for instance, Bloomberg Billionaires Index, you can see that on certain days there will be, take someone like Shel Nadelson or even Reid Hoffman, where their net worths will go up and down by, multiples of the $18 million that are putting into something like Alloy. So it's definitely a world which, for all of our concerns about money and politics, and it could be a lot worse as far as I know. It could definitely be more. I definitely do think there are projects out there that reporters are probably not capturing.
What's distressing about it, I guess, is even if it's not a huge amount of money for these people, it is certainly a lot more money than ordinary people can spend influencing politics. It's gigantically more than that. That's where it feels like something's awry. When one person can be equal to 50% of the country with their political expenditures.
I mean, I have to play devil's advocate here. I mean, look, I think there's two data points from the Democratic primary that should make people feel good about the role of money in politics. One is Mike Bloomberg spent, you know, $1 billion of his own money and, you know, got a couple of delegates out of American Samoa. Obviously, he did not have a message that caught on. And, you know, a billionaire spending way more than any of the people we're talking about are spending was not able to buy or frankly get really even close to winning the Democratic nomination. And then on the other point of the spectrum, you know, you have Bernie Sanders, who in 2016 and this time created a grassroots army. I think Elizabeth Warren this cycle showed that this was not a Bernie-specific phenomenon, that it was possible to replicate it too. And to some extent, Trump has replicated it also, right? So for all the attention we're spending on kind of these big, larger-than-life billionaire figures, there's an argument to be made that their profile is overinflated and that they can do their big passion projects and think they're changing the election, but maybe they're not. Who knows?
Do you find yourself feeling a sympathy to these billionaires who are, I think, probably on both sides, trying to do good for the country? I'm a partisan person, and I have trouble not being happy on some days that we have our Schmidts and our Moskowitzes and our Hoffmans, because I know the other side has got some of the other folks that are, you know, the Mercers and the Kochs and Schwabs and Mellons and so on. How do you think about that?
I don't know if I have sympathy, especially right now. There's a lot of other people I have sympathy for right now in the United States before some billionaires who are trying hard. You know, both sides are armed with their wealthiest people. And, you know, you talk to a lot of Democratic operatives about how they wrestle with the fact that they're calling for campaign finance reform at the same time that they are, you know, dependent on these billionaires. And you often hear the line, which was, I think came from Priorities USA in 2012, that we can't unilaterally disarm. You hear that, you know, that's the jargon phrase all the time, which, you know, Democrats have sort of struggled to get to that understanding. You know, I think even in 2012, even to some extent in 2016, there were Democrats who were a little queasy about this. And I think that's gone at this point. If it wasn't gone before Trump, it's gone with Trump and just the financial juggernaut that he's built on his own. There's a feeling that when win the White House and pass a constitutional amendment to get rid of Citizens United, and, you know, that's the party line at this point. I don't really hear anybody saying that these billionaires are unnecessary, except for Bernie Sanders. I mean, even Elizabeth Warren, it was always unclear whether or not she would embrace some of these people if she won the nomination. So there's definitely some questions about all this.
Everybody I've talked to on the progressive side who runs a super PAC always seems very apologetic for what they do. And they always say, I wouldn't do this, except I have to.
To give you the unilaterally disarm line?
Well, yeah, well, basically. Or they'll say, look, the Republicans beat us to this. After, I don't know, was it McCain-Feingold or whenever super PACs became possible or whatever, each innovation, they feel like the Republicans beat them to it. Then we get hammered in election. And so we have to catch up with our Senate majority PAC and our House majority PAC and, you know, all these conglomerations of fundraising for different types of races.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Democrats are catching up, right? I mean, they're catching up in a lot of ways, and this is one of them.
So I'm going to ask you the question in a different way about these billionaires. Do you think of yourself more as kind of like a muckraker about what's going on? Like, you know, I asked if you felt sympathetic, but do you feel like you're kind of digging into it and you're in that tradition of Lincoln Steffens and reporters around the turn of the century that were uncovering all of the evil doing in health and food and monopoly and things like that?
Yeah, I don't know if I would choose those words. I mean, to me, you know, as I said before, I think that, you know, billionaire power is something that deserves to have scrutiny. And I'm not coming to it as someone who, you know, is inherently a critic or inherently believes that people are doing evil things. I mean, if there are evil things that should be reported on and exposed, then definitely. I'm working on a story right now about a billionaire that I think is a broadly positive story. These are the sort of stories that you feel like you're never going to please anyone. You know, there's some people who think that billionaires should not exist and that any coverage that dignifies what they're up to is a war crime. Then there are other people who think that billionaires are hardworking people who made their money fair and square, and any effort to even scrutinize or even report on what they're doing is somehow out of bounds. So I'm a fairly traditional get the facts kind of guy. And at this point, I'm just trying to understand what's happening. And definitely that's not always easy. And I think a lot of people do not put out press releases on the most interesting stuff they're doing. And I'm just here to try and uncover what's going on.
One of the stories that you wrote was about the controversy around leadership change at vote.org.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell that story a little bit.
Sure.
I've, you know, followed a bit myself, but
I heard, actually cited your podcast interview with Andrea Haley. I linked to it, I believe. As a muckraker yourself, you might know that that was one of the few public comments they made about the CEO change at vote.org was on your podcast. So
I was aware of that. And I think that's when you came to my attention.
Okay.
In the way these things are. Yep.
Vote.org, for folks who did not listen to the other podcast, is this, you know, a voter engagement nonprofit that I think is one of the groups that has basically become much bigger, at least in the wake of 2016. And there's been a lot of Silicon Valley money that's flowed into vote.org. This was, you know, definitely a marquee organization that had a lot of powerful supporters, including Reid Hoffman, who we just talked about. And last year, it replaced its CEO in sort of a very, very messy, unusual boardroom fight. Andrea Haley, who's the new CEO, you had her on your podcast. Andrea, I believe, explained that there was a difference of opinion or something kind of vague. You pressed her pretty hard. I was glad because I did not get to interview her for the story. So I was glad you helped me out there, maybe unintentionally.
Well, I had also talked to Deborah Cleaver.
Before that? Okay.
Yes, who before this went down. And I had heard her side of the story. I had talked to some of her funders that really felt that she was not getting a good deal. They were, you know, firmly on her side. And so I was trying to figure out, like, what's the truth here? It's a little hard when you're not in the middle of it to ascertain. I felt a lot of sympathy for real reporters who try to disentangle this. And I mean, how did you think you came down in the story? Where do you stand on, like, who was the good guy, who was the bad guy, or what?
I think in that story, what we really tried to focus on was the impact, right? That this was a very marquee organization that really had its expertise and its DNA was vote by mail. So this is an organization that could have been playing a huge essential role in 2020 and basically had devolved into chaos, at least, you know, last year. And some people believe that's had impacts into this year. You're right. There's a lot of fingers pointed in any boardroom fight. But what was most interesting to me was, you know, for an everyday person who has never heard of vote.org, or is there some voter out there who would have gotten, you know, a vote by mail application in 2020 that they're not going to get because of kind of the chaos over there? I mean, I don't know, but I just tried to focus on the impacts more than anything, because I think what's indisputable, whether you believe Deborah's side of the story or Andrea Haley and the board side of the story, is that this has had an impact on one of the most important civic engagement groups in the country. So that's, I think, probably pretty sad for democracy.
Have you followed that Deborah went off and started a new organization and has picked up a bunch of $1 million to, you know, in her view, she's going to do it better, or is already, at Vote America?
I guess the best case scenario, as we write in the story, is that, you know, you have duplicative organizations, but, like, you know, there's a lot of voting rights organizations. There's, you know, Rock the Vote. There's other stuff out there. So what's one more in the pond, right? I mean, that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that these organizations are going to be bitterly fighting for months. You know, Deborah Cleaver submitted a complaint to the California Attorney General about her old organization, which probably tells you that this is not water under the bridge at this point. You're right. There's a lot of overlap with donors. So I think the worst case scenario is that you have this sort of cold war now between organizations that should be working together. So we'll see if they can bury the hatchet.
I mean, their main purpose is to register people to vote and turn out people to vote, which both pretty salutary parts of democracy. So I think you're right. What I found painful was the organization was Deborah's, you know, and she had created it from scratch and built it up over a decade. As a, I guess, a fellow entrepreneur, I always feel a little bit of pain around somebody having their baby taken away from them. without knowing all the details except her version and Andrea's version.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we write in the story, you know, if you live by a cult of personality, you die by a cult of personality. And I think that's probably one of the most essential truths of that story is that she was someone who, you're right, built this up with her bare hands. Like you bootstrapped your company, you know, she bootstrapped hers or raised very minimal funding for it. You know, I guess critics would say that she was never able to kind of build a scalable organization that could outlast her, right? I think there's a theory in business that, you know, the best founders create something that's so strong and so scaled that if, you know, they went on vacation for 8 months, no one would notice. That was not Vote.org. This was an organization that was highly dependent on its CEO and its founder, for better or for worse. So once she was ousted, there was a ton of chaos. Now, then again, like this would not be the first time in Silicon Valley that someone builds an organization that's a cult of the founder, but it just shows what happens when you get rid of the founder. Things can devolve pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a cult or it's just someone having actual expertise, but I agree that like there is that transition that a lot of organizations have to go through from founder to follow on CEO. I don't know if that was an excuse there or to oust her or what all the details were, but let's tangle with something else. What do you think Schmidt is up to in politics right now?
Sure. So Eric Schmidt, as I mentioned before, is someone who also believes in a democratic data revamp, but he is a very different idea than Reid Hoffman. So Schmidt is, you know, in 2016, sort of embedded this group of technologists in kind of in across the street from the Hillary Clinton campaign. And a lot of people feel this didn't really go that well from folks I've talked with. So Schmidt, this cycle, you know, he sort of has a different diagnosis for what's wrong with democratic digital politics and democratic data, which is that it's not that we just have bad, that Democrats just have bad data, but it's that they don't really know how to use it. So Schmidt kind of quietly set up this thing late last year called Stack Labs, STAC Labs, which another one of these things that has no website, no public profile, CEO, you know, on her LinkedIn page doesn't say she works there.
I can't get them to let me interview them, by the
really?
Way.
You've been trying?
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck. I'm almost laughing because these things are just so par for the course at this point.
Out of curiosity, did you talk to Schmidt to find out about this? Or does this come to you second or third hand?
There is a public job posting for Stack Labs that I linked to in the story. So if you if any intrepid people want to Google for it, it is at least was findable last week when I read the story.
And it's supposed to be helping state parties, right?
Right. It's helping. I think they might help other people too along the line. But for now, this is state parties to basically help them use their data more effectively. And I'm not by any means an expert on every nook and cranny of how the data world works. But the general theory is that it's not just that we have bad data, it's that we don't know how to use it. That's kind of Schmidt's thesis.
Probably true. There's another thing that you covered a bit that I thought was interesting was this, the donor advised fund world. As I understand those things, if you sell your company, say, or come into a large amount of money, you can make all your charitable deductions sort of for your life that year, get the tax write-off, and then hold on to that money and then spend it down over time, having already kind of front-loaded the deductions, the charitable deductions. But you covered that, how that's happening in Silicon Valley. Tell me what you saw.
Sure. I mean, this is something I'm super interested in. It's a great example of an opaque world of billionaire philanthropy that does not get the scrutiny it deserves. So donor-advised funds, you broadly characterize them correctly. These are ways you can get an immediate tax write-off for a donation, generally, usually in stock. But you don't have to spend the money on charity anytime soon or arguably forever. Some rules allow you to pass it down to your kids. So you can think of it as like a charitable checking account. So, you know, you sell your company, you have $5 million, you put $5 million into your donor advised fund or your DAF. You know, you sit on it, you spend $1 million in 20 years, maybe another 50K in another 5 years, and then you kind of gradually...
You can only spend it on 501c3 nonprofit.
Yeah, you're correct. You cannot spend this, you cannot get the tax write-off and then buy a Ferrari. Though I'm sure there are envelope pushers out there who, you know, I think there's some, you know, yeah. Generally, the idea is this is getting money spent on charity. So defenders of donor-advised funds say, look, this is just an efficient tax strategy. You cannot spend the money on a Ferrari. You cannot take the money back. That, you know, they get the tax break when it makes the most sense for them, and the money's going to charity eventually. So relax. That's the pro-DAF argument. The anti-DAF argument is a couple things. A, why are today's taxpayers giving a tax write-off for something that might not even accrue any benefit for society via charity for decades or maybe for longer? And I think the other argument centers on transparency. DAFs don't have to file a 990 with the IRS like foundations do. Charitable foundations have to give away 5% of their money every single year. Donor advised funds do not have that requirement. So there's about $120 billion right now in donor advised funds, which are popular now pretty broadly, but definitely the beating heart of this is in Silicon Valley. So these have become a huge industry, not just for nonprofits and for billionaires, but also for investment banks that have sort of, and for Wall Street that have gone into the donor advised fund game. So it's definitely something that I think a lot of nonprofit advocates say has hampered charitable giving, because sadly, a lot of this is about tax breaks. And if people can get a tax break without really giving the money away, that seems like a win-win.
What is another story that you've covered in the last year that you think people should know about?
I wrote a story about a month or two ago about the conversation around billionaire philanthropy more broadly during the coronavirus and what the obligations of the wealthy are. And I think attitudes towards billionaire charity are fascinating. For a long time in American society, charity was seen as like a universally good thing. It's like, you know, the Yankees, you know, or maybe not the Yankees, but the idea that like more charity was good. So more people giving away money was a, you know, a very easy round of applause. I think that's something that was believed to be, it was sort of boring, right? And over the last 2 to 3 years, there's been this, as kind of income inequality has increased, I think largely because of a couple of key books that sort of shifted the conversation around billionaire charity. Probably the most famous one is Winners Take All, which some listeners may have read. You know, I think there's been a reckoning in the world of billionaires, in the world of charity, that maybe rich people giving their money away could actually be a bad thing. You know, it's definitely counterintuitive. And like, you know, you say this to people who are unfamiliar with the argument and they think you're, you know, speaking Swahili. But ultimately, you know, I think there's a broad, fair conversation to be had about the impact of billionaires' gifts, which, you know, sometimes have direct harm on nonprofits. Sometimes they can skew public policy decisions, because I think the line between philanthropy and politics is razor thin. And what one person calls philanthropy, someone else would call partisan politics. Indirectly, billionaire philanthropy can have sort of the halo effect on the billionaire who gives it, right? So someone who gives away $500 million to charity, maybe you look the other way when they don't treat their workers well or, you know, cheat on taxes and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, the broad theme of understanding these charitable foundations and the tax advantages they get and whether or not that's a trade-off that we want to make is super fascinating.
Sanders had that refrain about the billionaire class. Do you find that resonating in the billionaire class? Does that piss them off? Do they refer to it? What's...
You mean the word billionaire?
Just the way that he sort of campaigned against that class. I think he spent a lot of time educating particularly young people to have a pretty baleful look at a group that might have been looked at much more positively before that.
I mean, look, I think this is a bipartisan vilification of billionaires. I mean, let's not forget during 2016, you know, I vividly recall Trump talking about the donors to the Republican National Committee, like at the RNC debates, you know, saying, you know, oh, these are all the billionaires' friends who are booing me. You know, I remember some of his tweets about Sheldon Adelson and Charles Koch. You know, Trump very much ran against billionaires, obviously, ironically, given who he is. These are easy targets. I think there's lots of these people are not totally comfortable defending their wealth publicly in a way that would probably give them more, you know, finesse in the political conversation. These are people who, you know, you don't want to see, you know, Jeff Bezos going out there and saying, actually, I do deserve my $125 billion. So it's sort of a one-sided argument. You do not see many billionaires defending billionairedom, which helps the Bernie Sanders of the world. But this is, you know, look, I mean, again, I think the goalposts have moved even since 2016. I remember this being sort of a seminal moment for me, at least, understanding the Democratic Party's relationship with billionaires. I think it was the CNN town hall in like January of 2019, you know, very early during the primary. And there was a question, I want to say it was to Kamala Harris, but I might be mistaken, about whether billionaires should exist. And this was like a, you know, sort of, I think maybe AOC was one of the first people that talked about that as an idea. But ultimately, you know, the goalposts have moved, and that is now a legitimate conversation on the left in a way that, you know, 5 years ago would be ludicrous should these people exist. We wrote a story at some point recently. People feel as negatively about billionaires today as they did during the recession. After the recession, people started feeling better about billionaires. And around the time of 2016, 2017, sentiment started nosediving. So people feel pretty negatively about these people in a way they haven't in about a decade.
I wonder how much, like, when Vice President Biden is selecting a VP running mate, how much he has to think about, like, well, if I pick Elizabeth Warren, it's going to piss off a lot of the people with money. She has an upside in that there's a bunch of people who like her, but the financial world really can't stand her.
Right. I mean, I think it depends which Elizabeth Warren we get. I mean, you know, as we wrote about, you know, Warren during the 2020 campaign, obviously ran very much against Silicon Valley billionaires, but this is somebody who during 2016, and as I recall, as late as the fall of 2018, you know, literally weeks before she was announcing she's running for president, was fundraising in Silicon Valley with Silicon Valley wealthy, you know, maybe not billionaires, but millionaires. So, you know, I think what temperature Warren's going to run at will be a question for her. But this is someone who definitely has the ability, if she would like to portray herself as a friend of the wealthy, at least keep things cool.
Well, she certainly eviscerated Bloomberg.
Right, right.
On that very issue.
But look, again, this is a political winner for her, and it's a political winner for a lot of Democrats. But at the end of the day, you know, the Biden campaign is going to need these billionaires to pony up. So there's definitely some concern that if Warren is if the vice presidential nominee, like, you know, will she do fundraisers? You know, Warren did a fundraiser for Biden, I think just last week, a high dollar fundraiser with, you know, astronomical ticket prices, which it was funny, you know, not to relitigate the 2020 primary, but I tweeted about the Warren Biden invite, which someone sent to me. And who was making fun of this? None other than all the former aides to Pete Buttigieg, who, you know, had not given up the Warren attack over the wine cave and stuff like that. You know, Buttigieg aides believed that Warren was hypocritical on this. So the fact that Warren was returning to do a high dollar fundraiser with the Biden campaign certainly brought some schadenfreude to Buttigieg land.
Yeah, I can see that. Is there a question that I have failed to ask you that you wish you could answer?
Not really. This has been fun. I got nothing else.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate the time, and it was a pleasure to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
Nope.
One question I meant to ask you, like, what is it like to work for the Vox Recode? How is that as a place to hang your hat, and how much do they, like, direct you versus you get to do your own thing?
I really enjoy working for Recode. I focus on, you know, these stories about kind of wealth because I think they're universal. I don't think you have to be a tech insider to care about these things. You know, the Vox.com audience is huge, and we try and bring sort of the inside baseball expertise of Recode to a broad audience in a way that, you know, Silicon Valley coverage has never been more important. So I'm pretty happy here.
That was Teddy Schleifer at Recode. He's at Teddy Schleifer on Twitter. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.